Scott, in a moment, we're going to announce the news about the TRN gear store. We're closing it down because we need to spend more time out on the trail and not behind the counter at the store. But you know what? I think if we had Path Project gear, the people wouldn't let us close down. They would demand that we stayed open because their gear is so strong.
It is in demand out there, and we've seen lots of people jump on this impressive bandwagon. I have to tell you, their hoodie,
the Pyrenees,
I wear all the time. The Pyrenees hoodie I'm wearing all the time. If I'm not working, or if I'm working and it's acceptable wear, I am wearing that Pyrenees hoodie. It's just so comfortable.
Are you a never nude, Scott? So you're showering with Path Project gear as well?
You know, I've never tried that, but I bet you it's just as comfortable in the shower as it is out.
Possibly my favorite piece of gear. Do love the Pyrenees. Absolutely the hoodie, but it's the shorts that make the magic happen, Scott. It is the base liner and the shorts that go over the top of it. And as some listener wrote in and said, it's as if the base liner becomes part of you. And the more miles you put in, the more intimate of a relationship it becomes. It's just no chafing and just happiness everywhere.
It's high quality gear at affordable prices. That's the reason why they're not going through brick and mortar stores. They're going directly to you. You can go to pathprojects.com and look at all their gear. Try it out. You will not be disappointed.
Lots of pockets in the shorts. I know that's one of your favorite things, Scott. Mm-hmm. You love the pockets and the utility. And people are buying packs and different types of things to wrap around their waist. And you can fill quite a bit up in the pockets, and they ride very nice. You don't even know the goo is there.
The store is closing, Don Freeman. It's a sad day for the TRN store, but yet there's a little bit of happiness there.
There's happiness because I saw a bunch of postage packages going out in the mail to lucky TRN gear recipients.
People are taking advantage of these low closeout prices. We still have plenty of gear, too.
Is that right?
We actually have quite a bit of it, and everything is must go, as they say, when the stores close. Everything is $10. We have baseball caps, the red, white, and blue, the ocean sand. We have the buffs. We have the sleeves. We have the reversible beanies. It's all in there. Everything's $10.
You know, that's a great price. And if you're going to buy one piece, you might as well buy a bunch and give them out as gifts. The holiday season is coming. Gift mm-hmm. yourself and gift your trail friends. And this gear, people that use it, people that have it, they love the quality of this gear. It really is awesome. We searched around, found the best, and then put our name on it.
We did. So check it out at trailrunnernation.com. Click the store.
Dr. Romanoff, you're probably very experienced at professional interviews. This is not one of them.
Come on. Don't put yourself down.
we are very casual. That's a good word.
Ashley, were you expecting a professional podcast?
No, I wasn't. Apparently not. Sorry, guys.
Yeah. And it was a miserable, miserable day.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation.
We're recording, right?
We are recording, Scott. And Andy Jones-Wilkins, our East Coast executive producer, is on the line. And this is what's called an audible. Not because I'm speaking audibly, because we show up to the line, we look around, we find out it's not a 10K trail race. It's actually a 100-mile trail race. We better do something and do something quick.
We brought no nutrition.
We have no nutrition.
We brought our racing flats.
We didn't bring any squirrel's nut butter, so chafage is possible on this journey. AJW, what the heck are we talking about? Ease us into this event.
We didn't bring our lucky poles either, because we were thinking we were doing a 5K. But so what we're going to audible on today, everybody, is we're going to talk a little bit about how feeling bad about that race you missed out on. Looking around on social media or hearing from your friends about all the great successes that they've had on the trail. And when you feel kind of like you missed out on something. And, you know, the topic started as I was asking Don just a little while ago, if you missed being at Moab, this Moab 240 this past year, because this past week, because he was busy recovering from his adventure at Tour de Jeanse. And he said, without skipping a beat, absolutely. He missed it a little bit when they started. He missed it a little bit more as he was hearing stories from the trail. And then to hear the triumphs from the finish line, man, it gave him a full-blown case of wishing he'd been there. So the topic today is the race that could have been.
hey, Don, did you even think about Moab before this weekend, before the weekend started?
Oh, about spontaneously showing up and just hoping that...
You're kind of the spontaneous kind of guy. I was thinking that maybe 24 hours beforehand, you'd hop in your car and drive for 30 hours to get to the start line.
Had it not been for some work obligations, Scott, that would have been consideration. I may have done that because there's nothing like just being spontaneous and showing up, and it makes a big difference. I do like that. But Andy, I really liked your question, and I like the fact that there's so much to this racing that it is just not out there running. We enjoy the community, but we enjoy the challenge. And man, I really, and I don't know if you guys, I don't want to get too far ahead in the conversation, but it always occurs to me, eventually this is going to end. Eventually, I'm not going to have a choice to do this race. I just may be physically eliminated from some of these options. And that's always something that is in the back of my mind, and I don't want it to come too soon, and it'll make me quite envious of not even missing a race, but maybe missing out on some of my sport. Do you guys ever think about that?
I'm afraid I do, and I'm experiencing a little bit of ultra running heartache this fall. You know, I think most listeners know I had surgery back in the spring on a hip that had been bugging me for a while. And I knew it was in April, of course, which is a terrible time to get any sort of surgery because it, you know, kind of cancels out the rest of your summer. And, you know, I dove in pretty aggressively to kind of supporting other runners at other races and attending other runner races and kind of being part of the other side of the trail, if you will. I went to Western States, I went to Vermont, I went to the Yeti 100, and I just most recently went to Grindstone 100. So I went to four very different 100-mile races where I knew dozens and dozens of people who were running, and I was rah-rah and cheering all along. And I have to admit, though, here I am sitting after that whole time, and I do feel a little bit of heartache that I think I'll run one of these things again. My recovery is moving along fine. But I have to admit, I'm a little bit envious. And I think that envy is good and maybe fuels the fire for recovery. But it also does make you think, as you said, Don, someday this is all going to be over. I just hope it's not now.
Yeah, you know, as you were stating that, it sounded a lot like my explanation of a DNF. I put a real positive spin on it, but there was something deep inside that does kind of eat at you, and I really regretted not finishing that, even though I tried to put a positive spin. I think I just heard a positive spin, AJW, being out there and around that must be hard not to want to lean forward and grab a bottle and just a bib and go.
You know, it's interesting. I had the first three races, I wasn't really recovered enough even to pace. But this past week at Grindstone, you know, I was recovered enough so I was able to pace just for short spells. I paced one runner for 8 miles, another runner for 10 miles. And I have to admit, even getting out there for that short period of time, you know, relit the fire.
You know, that was a question I had. You know, we see at these races people that have been icons in our community and at every race and volunteering and not only racing but volunteering. But now they've gotten to a point where maybe they're not able to run as much or even race as much. And they're still there volunteering. So my question to you is, from your own perspective, can you still stay close to the sport after you're no longer able to run versus I have a good friend, or had a good friend, once he couldn't run anymore, he had to stay away. It just hurt him too much to be close to even a race, even talk about running. Well,
Joe Montana was the same way. Not that I was friends with Joe as a quarterback for the 49ers, but there was a time he was done with the Super Bowls, and then he just kind of disappeared from being a spectator. From what I hear, he couldn't get close to it again because of he missed it so much. It hurt too much to watch. So, what's your thought on that, Andy?
Well, I do know. Someone we've talked to before on the podcast, Ann Trason, was certainly in that situation. She spent about 10 years completely away from the sport after she finished her runs at Western States and had some injuries that meant she wasn't going to run anymore. You might recall she doesn't have the house anymore, but she even owned a house that was literally right on the course, right outside Michigan Bluff. And every year at race week, she would pack up and go somewhere far away, you know, go trekking in Asia or travel to Europe because she just had to be away. Over the passage of time, she was able to get back, and now she's back involved in the race and volunteering at Michigan Bluff every year and coaching athletes and so forth. But she needed that time away. You know, for me, I think there would likely be a grieving process. If indeed it is, I've run my last 100-miler, I would certainly have some grieving go on. But I would not. I wouldn't be able to stay away. I just love the community so much. And I think there are so many ways to give to the sport, whether through volunteering or coaching or hanging out or just being part of it, that being on podcasts like this and other ones. I think there's just too much to love about the community to stay away. I think you need to remove your ego a little bit and accept the fact that it's something you've lost. But I think once you do that, you can continue to be a part of the celebration of the sport for a long, long time afterwards.
We mentioned at the beginning of this podcast that we pulled an audible, and I'm going to come back to what it was originally supposed to be is a podcast about the book Tribe by Sebastian Younger. And he mentions in his book as Native American tribes, you know, everybody had their job within the tribe, even the elders. That weren't able to go out and hunt and gather anymore. They had a role in the tribe, but then there were some tribes that had situations where somebody got to a certain age and they would just one day wander off into the wilderness because, you know, at some point they didn't feel that they were a value to the tribe. Mm. So that's kind of interesting perspective as we're talking about missing racing and, you know, for whatever reason, whether you are injured or whatever.
You know, it's interesting, as you guys know, recently the Ironman National Championships out in Kona took place, and that race really values its elders. They every year the veterans come back. You know, Scott Tinley and Dave Scott and the great veterans of Chrissy Wellington, and they really honor them. They wear special shirts and so forth, and they do you know, speeches, and they're around the expo. They're celebrated as past champions, kind of much the same way that former golfers are celebrated at the Masters Championship. So I do think there are ways that events can also help the elders of the sport stay present beyond their running, whether it's Ann Trason aid station working at Western States or some of the legends of Hard Rock or Angeles Crest still being around those races. I think that's a really special part of the sport and something where the tribal aspect can, you know, you value your elders sitting around the fire, giving you wisdom long after the days of them being out hunting the big game are over.
Do you think we could do or should do better than we are? Do you think we're making any effort at highlighting our elders and allowing some of their knowledge and wisdom to pass down to us? Or do you think we could do a better job?
I think we're in a stage right now where we could definitely do a better job. I think it's mainly because of the age of the sport. We're we're a lot about the flavor of the month, you know, and the runner that's running really well this year. You know, I was astounded, for example, back in August when Rob Krar won Leadville. Not that I wasn't astounded that he won. I knew he was fit and ready to go. But that, you know, people were talking about him as if he was this person who had kind of come from, you know, years and years ago and had made this incredible comeback. He did make an incredible comeback because he had a major surgery and so forth. But he was the Western States champion in 2014 and 2015. So it was just a few years later that he won Leadville. But he was largely forgotten, swept up in the, you know, the next latest, coolest runner. So I do think that there is a place for the mentors and the legends in the sport. I've found, for example, the series I've been writing this year for I Run Far on the history of the sport, where I've been profiling an individual runner each month, whether it is Ann Trason or Tom Nielsen or Nikki Kimball or most recently Ben Hyen. And many of the readers have written back and saying, I love hearing about the history of the sport. And I think some of these people are so humble and they're so soft-spoken and below the radar that unless someone pushes them out in front of people, they're not necessarily going to be that kind of tribal elder. So, yeah, absolutely. I think we could do a lot better job celebrating those legends of the sport and giving them time to share with the sort of younger, newer folks in the sport.
You know, maybe we need to have more of those on the podcast and sharing their story and their successes and their wisdom. I mean, we do it on the trail, right? We go out to the trail and we run these training runs with people that have been doing this for decades. And we love to hear the wisdom that they have. That's one of the things that I frankly drew me to the sport that I just love.
Well, we rely on that experience and wisdom. I remember some of my original questions and I always smile when I think about them. Because I would ask an established runner, a veteran runner, hey, in the race, do you run this hill or do you hike this hill? You know, I just had all these questions, like, you know, I didn't know anything. And I was just listening to anything they said and figured that was the absolute right answer. No, we walk this. And they'd always kind of I think they would smirk after they'd look at each other. The veterans would gaze at one another like, look at this new guy.
Did they tell you the truth?
I don't know. I think so.
Hey, Andy, who are some of the mentors that you had early in your running career? Who taught you the ropes?
Oh, number one top of the list is Tom Nielsen. I think you guys probably know Tom, and mm-hmm. I'd love to get him on the podcast sometime. Tom lives down in San Diego, and he started running ultras in, you know, 91, 92. And was a real sort of fixture in the Southern California scene. And when I was coming into the sport and moving up to 100 milers, I lived in Arizona at the time, traveled out to Southern California quite a bit to train. And he did exactly that, Don, but he didn't even wait for me to ask the question. We would just be running along and then he would just be like, hey, AJ, we walk this. And so it wasn't even a, you know, hey, should we walk this or what do you think about what? It was just like, we walk this. And, you know, we stop here and fill our bottles at this spring. Or, you know, we don't wear trail shoes. We wear road shoes. I mean, just very like definitive, the ultimate sort of tribal wisdom. And then, of course, you've got to talk about mentors of anybody who's run Western States has to talk about Tim Tweetmeyer. I mean, sure. You go on a run with Tim Tweetmeyer and he's telling you stories about this thing or that thing that happened and when they moved the trail from here to there and, you know, how terrible it was when it used to be this way and that way. I mean, it's just awesome. And one of my great memories of this year's Fast Western States is Tim and I were standing around at Forest Hill and there were kind of a lot of people around. I think a couple of the front runners had just came through and he turned to me and he's like, AJW, doesn't this make you so glad that we don't have to run this anymore? And he said it kind of really loudly and you could sort of see all these people around. And I was like, absolutely, man, I'm so glad I don't have to run this thing anymore. But it was just like such a classic kind of Tweetmeyer thing. And so, yeah, those legends and those mentors, Tommy and Tim especially, are certainly people. And then, you know, we've talked about Kevin.
We just lost.
We lost Andy. Hey, while we're waiting for him to come back, Don, it reminds me of the time before I ran Western States. I went and fast-packed Western States with a friend, and it was, you know, of course, not during, you know, there's no aid stations, and I was asking you, because I had never even been on the trail. I mean, some of the latter parts I'd been there, but a lot of it not been on. That would know where the water is along the way. And I can't remember. Do you remember who you asked? But whoever you asked said, this is where there's water here. There's water here. And I remember one place there was like an old, he says, you're going to come up on an old house. And on the left-hand side is this broken down vehicle that's been there since the 30s. And if you walk 50 yards beyond that and then hang a left off the trail and walk 30 yards off the trail, there's a spring there. Do you remember that?
It's Dana Gard is who you're thinking of. He's the master of the
Dana
trail.
Gard, yeah.
He knew exactly. He told you, and then you relayed it to me, exactly every place that we should stop and get water and where to avoid. And it was just amazing.
You know, those guys were
know all that.
Those guys were before GPS. And now that we have GPS, we can check in and know exactly where we are. But the wisdom that was passed on back in the day was this rock, from this rock is 20 minutes to the aid station. From this, you know, a landmark, this tree with the Y, where the branches come up and make a big Y means you're just 2 minutes away from now the next aid station. It was just information about placement and position that was passed along that was indispensable. I mean, it was good stuff because we didn't have the tools.
Well, and one of the ways that would then evolved and is still true today is out of that, we would also say, now this is a really good place to take a gel, or this is a really good place because you're definitely going to walk here on race day and you're going to walk for 5 minutes. So it's a good place to get nutrition, or, you know, when there was a lot of attention, and as there always is at races that are notoriously hot, right? This is a really important place for you to dunk your head and soak. I mean, the wisdom of the elders in that regard is invaluable to people.
And that information you remember for a long time. Scott knew the exact number of feet to that car, to that water faucet or fixture there.
There's a spring.
And I can recall that it's 20 minutes through the sandy bottom section. Just information that's just said one time that stays with you for your entire career in the racing. It's very important.
I've actually gotten in a lot of trouble with my wife about that, because she often says, you remember every rock on the Western States course, but you can't remember the three things I told you to pick up at the store.
I can't help you with that, AJW. I can't help you with that. You're on your own there.
I think it goes back to our primitive survival instincts. If you don't bring back the broccoli from the grocery store, no one's going to die. There's no pain involved. Hey, if you don't fill up at the spring with water, you know you have another 10 miles without water. It's going to be suffer fest.
AJW, you cut out earlier and you were talking mentors and you mentioned the name and I've got to think that's Kevin Sawchuk.
You got it. Yes, I was talking about Kevin Sawchuk because there are also those mentors that were also competitors, right? So you know, Tim Tweetmeyer and Tom Nielsen, I wasn't a direct competitor with them because they were earlier than I and they were in a class by themselves. But then you have those mentors who were sort of co-competitors, and Kevin Sawchuk was one of those mentors where we went back and forth in several races, literally competing with one another. And then, of course, seconds after the race finished and we congratulate one another, you know, we're sort of just talking and conversing and having, you know, conversations that are just they're just gold in the information that come out of those conversations. And I can think of Eric Skadden as another one who I had several kind of battles with at Western States. Joe Kulak, an old East Coast friend of mine, former Grand Slam record holder, Ian Torrance, who's been around a long time. These are more sort of peer runners where you kind of mentor one another without really trying to mentor one another. And those are really rich experiences and rich relationships, but frankly, to this day, that, as you know, all of us are sort of on the backside of our competitive careers, still, you know, value immensely those relationships.
You know, some of this wisdom that you get for certain races, you know, you get just because you've been running with the right crowd or know the right people to contact. Andy, I think it was 2 years ago, you went out to Wyoming and ran the Bighorn 100?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bighorn, yeah.
Did you have any wisdom or intelligence going into that race? How did you find out the tribal knowledge of the Bighorn 100?
Ooh, tribal knowledge, yeah.
You know, fortunately, I had two good friends who'd been on the course several times. Jeff Browning is one, and Carl Meltzer is other, and those are two guys that are not at all protective about information or anything like that. I mean, and I just reached out to them and said, "Hey guys, give me the scoop." And you know, they had all kinds of ways in which they could create parallels with things that would be common to us, the Appalachian, right? So the Appalachian Trail or Grindstone or Hard Rock or Western States. And so they were able to sort of make comments and draw parallels between the experience I would likely have at Bighorn with some of those other experiences. And as a result of that, we kind of had a common dialogue and they were able to give me the support I needed. That said, I don't think anyone was prepared for the mud that year. And neither of those guys had ever had a concussion at mile 61 of a 100-mile race, so they didn't have much to give me there. But certainly that's the other thing. If you have enough relationships, you know, let's say you're running. I mean, let's say I was going to go do Tour de Jean someday, right? I'd certainly want to get in touch with Don. I'd want to talk to Avery Collins. I'd want to talk to Jez Bragg, who just did Tour de Jean. I mean, I think if you have enough of a big network of friends, you can always find someone. Of course, when I ran my first Hard Rock, I immediately reached out to Rock Horton, and he wrote me like an 8-page email of, wow, you know, a description of every rock on the course. The other thing that helps for that to happen is you sort of pay that forward to other people. I mean, anytime, and you can imagine this happens to me every single year, I get requests from people for beta and information about races that I've done a bunch of times, Western States, Vermont, Angeles Crest, and I'll do the same thing. I'll just sit down at the computer and just fire away with a course description and ideas about the course and suggestions I would make and things not to do. I think it's good karma to do that. And then if you need that done for you, you know, it'll likely happen.
You know, that's one of the cool things about the community too, is that people are more than willing to share. I mean, there's so much information that's on the internet, whether you're using the social media or if you're just going on and Googling, you know, Bighorn 100 course report. And there's blogs out there of just people you don't even know that can give you relevant wisdom for that race.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just freely shared. That's what I love about this sport, is no one's trying to protect any kind of competitive advantage.
Hey, let's talk about that. You have something to add to that comment, AJW? Let's talk about freely share. I think that is a good kind of a segue to it. I was talking to Bob Crowley about yesterday about his experience, a recent successful experience at Moab 240. And we were talking about conversation on the trail. And we've all experienced it, how what's so unique and wonderful, I think, is to be able to go out and run for X number of hours and just dig into topics in depth and without reservation. And why is it that spending a few hours poolside with somebody is so much different than running along a trail with somebody? You end up, I think, that I'm just going to throw some of the thoughts that I had as I was talking to Bob about that, is I think that we naturally break down the energy it takes to create a facade of who I want you to think I am disperses once I start getting deep into the miles. I don't have the energy to keep up this false pretense of who I want you to think I am. I think once we get out there and we start running along and blister, you know, chafage can happen and just the heat of the day and just fatigue, we start to become more raw and we are able to express our true feelings and we have less reservations about what we say. And as a result, the other person, perhaps in the same spot, you're exchanging in a conversation that would never happen poolside. You guys have any thoughts on that? Should I spend more time at the pool?
We have an adage in education, and especially in working with parents, that you often hear from your kids at the sort of least likely moments, and it's almost a universal truth that one of the best places to get kids to open up is when you're driving in the car, right? You're driving and they're sitting in the passenger, almost as if you're not there. I almost feel like the same for being out on the trail and for being out. I remember the first time I experienced it very early in my running career. Before I started running ultras, I had a running partner, Bill Waskowitz. He and I taught together at Phoenix Country Day School. And then we ran every afternoon or 3-4 afternoons a week and went out. And we would sort of start by talking about school. And, you know, within 20-30 minutes, it was about our relationships and our spouses and our parents and our fears and hopes and dreams and so forth. And then, you know, then a couple of years later, Bill moved away and I moved away. And, you know, we've been apart now for 20 years. But every so often, because we're both still in education, we sort of cross paths and get out for a run together. And it's like it never ended. It's like we pick up exactly where we left off, and we're talking, and it's that same sort of thing. You're just running, you're just moving along, and just stuff comes out. The other thing that happens is you feel like if you're on the trail with a person for a couple of hours and you've been talking, you feel like you've known them your whole life, right? And you and often it is like what happened to you at Don at Tour de Jante. You know their kids, their wife, their spouse, how many divorces they've had. You know everything about them, you know, and because they've just sort of spouted it out. And it's just amazing and wonderful. And it's not the kind of thing you would get poolside. Frankly, it's not the kind of thing you would get in regular life very much at all, unless you sort of forced yourself to do it. And that sort of defies the point, because you can't force someone to open up. But the opening up that takes place out there on the trail is just remarkable, and one of the great gifts of the sport.
So you can run with somebody for 4 hours and know and learn more about them and become more connected than someone you've known for 4 years or even 10 years. You can really establish that relationship. I know that when Bob had come back from Moab, he talked about some of the wonderful conversations that he had with some of the runners and commitments. And when they were done, it was, boy, I'm sorry that we're finished with this. What are we going to do next together? You know, let's pin a race on the calendar that we can all show back up and reunite and do this again. And I have the same feeling with the people that I went through that challenge with. You know, there's a connection and a bonding that happens out there that's so important. And I think when we get pushed to the end, we get pushed to our limit, we look to make very close connections and very, very close relationships for survival. I'm thinking anthropologically, back in the day when we were getting hunted or people were hunting us, that when danger was around, you had to rely on the person next to you. And I think we get close to that, some of that same type of stuff.
I would say, going back to Scott's question too, about if you couldn't do it anymore, you know, would you have to run away from the sport? You know, I think more than the races, that's what I would miss. Mm-hmm. You know, that 4-hour run connecting with that person, you know, and maybe I would have to find that other thing. Maybe it would be hiking. Maybe it would be cycling or something. I've heard that works for people also in this sort of bonding way. In my world, though, nothing beats a 4-hour run, you know, for getting it all out there and so forth. So I think more than if you said to me, look, you're done running 100 milers, you know, what are you going to do? I'd be like, hey, yeah, I'd be okay. But if it's like you're done being able to go out for a 4-hour run with a group and exchange your life story, that would be a lot harder to say goodbye to. Mm.
I have a question for you guys. Do you feel that you get that same type of connection with the shorter races? And I don't want to minimize those shorter races. I mean, a 50K is really, really hard. A half marathon is really hard. A 10K is really hard. But from a length standpoint, in a 50K, can you have that same kind of a deep discussion where people open up in a 50K versus a 100 miler or a 100K?
Andy, I'm gonna throw something out there first, because I see you still thinking as you're looking into the the distance. I think that for a 50K, if the individual or the individuals are being pushed to that end and to that limit, their personal limits, I think those bonds will happen. There's enough time in that race that bond can happen. If you're on your 50th 50K, it's probably, you know, not going to do that for you, and I think you probably miss out on that. But I think any time that we're pushed, we connect. And so I think it's not as much distance as, you know, the experience. AJW?
Yeah, I think you've hit on something here. I do think the longer it goes, though, Scotty, the more that connection can be made, and in fact, the more sometimes even dependent the relationship can be. I was reminded of being at Grindstone last weekend, and on a couple of occasions later in the race, you know, post mile 70, at those aid stations, I clearly saw runners that were waiting for each other to leave the aid station together. Mm-hmm. And they hadn't necessarily, we're talking about sort of mid to back of the pack folks. They had not necessarily made a pact or a deal, but it was dark. It was getting cold. You know, there was just, neither of them had pacers. And so I think that might not have happened at mile 25 mm-hmm. of a 50K, but it's certainly going to happen at mile 75 of a 100-miler. And they're thinking, and in many cases, they're trying to just keep each other awake on the trail. Yeah. And that serves a real valuable purpose, by the way. And when you're trying to stay awake, Lord knows the stuff that comes out of your mouth. So those conversations could be even more thoughtful and emotional.
That's where the saying, what's said on the trail stays on the trail. You know, the reason why I bring it up is, you know, in my personality, I would say I'm a little bit shyer, and I don't go out. I'm not an outward guy that would going down the trail and say, "Hey, let's run together."
This is coming from a guy that has a podcast, by the way, AJW. Yeah. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, Scott. It's me neither.
It's a character that I play on the radio, but that's why I bring it up, because for me, I don't start having those conversations until I've passed the person and they've passed me a few times and you say hi. I mean, I'm not the kind of guy that doesn't say hi. I'll say, "Hey, how's it going? Are you doing okay?" But that's about as far as it goes. But after you do that a few times, that's where the conversations, that's where I start building that relationship after a few times. And so that's mm-hmm. the reason why I asked.
Yeah, I've always thought you were kind of a like wallflower, hard to read guy, you know, Scott War, mysterious man of mystery. Yeah.
I can put on a persona. I'm in sales and marketing, and I can put on a persona when I'm with a customer too. But if it comes down to my natural tendencies, I'd rather stay quiet and not talk to anybody.
I mean, I can even think of the first time I met Don. You know, our mutual friend Julie kind of was organizing a training run out on the Western States course, and we just went out on the course and we struck up conversation within seconds out of Forest Hill. And I think the conversation only ended when we kind of, you know, when the group separated a little bit. But it was, you know, it was like instant practically. And then it was just a couple months later, you were like, "Hey, AJW, I'm starting this new podcast thing."
yeah. You know, what's interesting is I actually build better relationships on a training run than I do at a race.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly that's because if you see somebody in the parking lot as you're going, you know, you may be able to share some miles with them. And I feel less like I'm holding someone back if I'm talking to them, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. So I actually think I do better when I'm just on a training run.
You know, I've told the story before, but I love telling it because I was newer in the sport. I was so proud of myself that I was able to run with Julie, who's a great runner herself, and AJW. And I patted myself on the back after 8 miles of sticking with these two elite athletes. And then we get to, it was Michigan Bluff, and there's a big downhill. And my goodness, AJW took off. All I saw were his heels and dust in the first corner, and he was gone. And I realized right then that there is another type of animal out there that runs on these trails.
And it's possible to run that fast downhill.
I couldn't believe it. It was a reason he's a top tenner at the big dance there. So I think
I might have said something like, "Hey, I hope you don't mind. I think I'm going to push this one a little bit," or something like that.
Yeah, that's when my ego was shattered, because I thought we were pushing, because I was on my push. I think some of the reasons why we allow ourselves to be trusted in deep ways out there on the trail that we are referring to is that if we were back and we were being threatened by something, we would have to really rely on one another. We would really have to trust with absolute certainty that this person has your back, that no matter what, you're going to be a team together. And I think our DNA leads us and points that direction. And the trail running, when it gets hard, allows us to express what's always been there and waiting to be used and waiting to be released. And in today's society that's so safe and so comfortable with refrigerators and thermostats, we long for a little bit of that hard stuff. And that's why we sign up.
And to tease a little bit more about what this podcast was scheduled to be before we called the Audible, is about this whole tribe thing. And Sebastian, in his book, talks about the whole idea that a tribe is a small group of people that will help each other survive. That each individual is there and they're willing to lay down their life and comfort so that you can have that comfort. You mentioned in the book after, during World War II, where people were sleeping, people didn't even know each other, were sleeping very, very close quarters, and they felt safe even though all this bombing was going on and their lives were in danger. They felt safe because they were with a group. And I think that's part of just our instinct as primates to be together and feel safe in a group.
Some of the most inspiring stories that have come out of ultra running, in my view, in the last 10 years, have been stories when a person or a group of people have abandoned their race for helping another runner. I recall Amy Albu back here in Virginia about 6 years ago, literally broke her leg on a creek crossing and at the Promised Land, or no, at the Holiday Lake 50K. And six people pretty much stopped their race to create a makeshift stretcher and bring her back to the to the starting finish line, and their race was done. I heard of two runners back in the notoriously hot 2006 Western States who encountered a runner in deep, deep trouble coming up Devil's Thumb, kind of delirious and not, speaking, slathering their speech and so forth. These people who happened to be, wilderness first responders stopped, tended to the person, were there for a long, long time, went up to the aid station, got someone to come down. I mean, you hear these stories from our sport of people, and where this is Western States, right? People have waited 7 years to get in from the lottery, and they see this person in trouble, their instinct is going to kick in, and they're going to stop and support that person. I'm sure these things happen in other sports, but man, when they happen in our sport out there in the wilderness, and these runners give of themselves to support others, that sends a message to all of us that, hey, people have my back, I'm going to have their back.
That reminds me, as you were talking about that, of, and Don, you may or may not remember this. This was a Bigfoot in the later, it may have been probably, maybe 10, 15 miles left in the race. But there was another racer, a friend of ours, that got lost on the course. And here comes Candace Burt, race director. And she says, "We've lost a runner. We've noticed with the GPS tracking that they're off course and we're going out to find him." And there was all of a sudden, just impromptu, all these people at the aid station, including some runners, they're saying, "Hey, how can we help? Can we go out there and help you? Is he hurt? Do we need to take medical supplies?" And I was just surprised. I mean, there was no question, no hesitation. Everybody just jumped in. And that's really cool. And it goes back to that whole tribe culture.
Well, that reminds me of when I was at Tour de Jeanne, and it's kind of halfway through the race, and it was at the highest point of one of the mountains, and it's all very technical and rocky, and you've got to watch every step as you're coming down. And all of a sudden, two responders, first responders with backpacks, full-size backpacks, come cruising past us at breakneck pace. I mean, whatever we were running or fast hiking, they were two or three times faster. Amazing agility going down there, and they were going after to rescue somebody that had fallen off the side a bit. It turned out he was okay, but he was okay because of the speed of these first responders. Those people are an important part of the community, and they're serving a big purpose, and they're an important part of our group too. And they didn't have bibs on, but they were integral and important. So there are many people, aid station workers, people that set the race up, people that tear it down, people that clean up the water jugs. I mean, everybody's role is very, very important, just not bib wearers. I mean, we're probably least important.
One of the more interesting and eclectic members of the tribe are the ham radio operators. I mean, getting into that culture is fascinating, but some of those people, they'll set up camp out in the middle of nowhere for 72 hours, and they've not run a step in their lives, no. But they're there to make sure every runner gets through, every runner is accounted for, everything happens the way it's supposed to. I mean, that sort of giving of themselves is, you see it just from the radio guys. It's fantastic.
That's a really interesting point, because as far as I know, most of those ham radio operators are not runners. And yet they're there to give of their time for this community. They're not getting paid. They're just doing it because that's who they are. That's in their nature. Of course, they like to dink around anytime they can with their radios.
Right.
And I will say I have a ham radio license, so I don't consider myself part of their tribe, but it intrigues me.
Scott, their dogs don't even run. I mean, there's been a generation since somebody's run in that group. But they're right there.
We got to be careful. We better be careful. Those guys are going to save your life one of these days.
And I mean, in some of these remote courses, I mean, even Western States is not all that remote, but just because of the nature of the geography, there are places where you're not going to get a spot tracker or something like that that's going to get reception, and you're literally dependent on those ham radio guys. And so, I mean, they serve an incredible, incredible purpose for us, and we couldn't really do what we do without them.
They get a race shirt, a finisher shirt, yeah, of some kind.
how do we repay the ham radio people? Do we buy them some
that shirt,
copper
Scott,
cable or something?
No, that shirt I told you about. Those are valuable.
That's all.
Valuable
that's
things.
What they do it for is the shirt.
Yeah, that's what we do it for.
Maybe they do it for the M&Ms at the aid station table.
Yeah, it's funny. They set the ham operators a bit away from that table, the refueling aid station table. They're on a card table that folds out with kind of a rickety chair, and so we need to get them a little bit sweeter spot to sit with a good shelter.
Oh, that's great.
So I think absolutely we all that are participating and have bibs on look and know the forecast holds a final race for us, because inevitably that just has to happen. And I don't know how you prepare yourself for that. Some of it happens slowly as we leave our best races behind us. You know, my fastest time, I believe, has probably been run, and because nothing is probably going to get any faster than I've done. It is based on time, and there's a sadness to that too, and something that needs to be managed. And I think a prelude really to leaving completely from the running is just watching your times slip, and that's
that all depends. That all depends, Don. You know, have you ever run a 5K?
Yes.
Okay. You haven't run a 300-mile race, so you can still have a PR at a 300-mile race.
Oh, I think that's why we probably choose different races and different venues, and the 200 has become appealing to me because the PRs are much more plentiful for me on 200s because I haven't done them before. So nothing to compare my past, and I like that about different distances and different races.
In the longer events, 100K and 100 mile, which is as long as I've done, I've got 200 on the brain sometime down the road. But for me, in the longer events, I've actually embraced the slowing down in a way that I spend a lot more time in the aid stations and experiencing those aid stations. The younger me was flying through there with a NASCAR pit crew and not even, you know, blinking an eye in those, and also spending time, you know, from time to time actually stopping on the trail, stopping to take in a view, stopping to take a picture with my phone. These are things that were completely foreign to me in my sort of front end of the field days and are now part and parcel of the experience. And I think are very enriching for me and are part of what is going to keep me coming back, I think. I do think there are a lot of people who were fast and they don't have an interest in the sport, but I think there are a lot and an increasing number, by the way, who are sort of in my situation where they were fast and now they're not so fast, and they're open and accepting of that. And that's actually a pretty fun place to be and makes me look forward to the next time I'm able to get out there, which will hopefully be next year.
Oh, yeah. And your fellow runners that are around you, happy to welcome you to Midpack, because we have a lot of fun in Midpack and Backpack. We enjoy it, and we often think about you guys up front, especially when we know you're done with the race and we're still in the middle of it. But there's plenty of room for you front packers to come on back with us.
There's a lot more partying that goes on in the mid and the back.
Do you know who I've seen spend the most time? You said spending time in an aid station. We live in the same area as Gordy Ainsley, and that man can spend some time at an aid station.
He knows how to gab. He's not a shy one, is he?
He talks to everybody there and samples all of the food and goes back to what he likes best. And he has embraced the sport, absolutely, from all angles.
He signs autographs. He takes pictures, you know.
if he has enough, he's
got to work on that vitamin D, you know. He's got to be out there for many, many, many hours.
Our sport is young and still forming, and it's fun to watch it evolve and be part of it. And anybody that's participating, anybody that's out there running, is part of it. And so I enjoy that. Scott,
you know, did you guys have? I love taking people out and showing them the trails, and just seeing their. It's almost like childlike wonder. You know, they've started running on the roads, or they've been running on roads for a long time, and you say, hey, let's go out to the trail, and how they just, their eyes get big. And I just love that, and being able to share our sport, because frankly, there's a lot of trail out there. I don't think we'll ever be overcrowded.
You know what I love, and you guys can speak to this. I love taking a road runner out and them saying, oh, we're going to do, for instance, 20 miles. And they have in their head that this is going to take a very short time.
Right. It's not a half-day event.
Yeah, this could be about 4 hours, guys. And it's, what? 4 hours? No way. And then next thing you know, we're taking 5 hours.
Yeah. Oh, I've had experiences like that where the said road runner has kind of looked at their watch and been like, hey guys, I gotta go. I gotta be back. My wife's waiting for me. And we're like, well, dude, where are you gonna go, man? We're at the top part of this loop. The only place you can go is, so it's gonna be a good old 6 hour 20 miler. And it's lucky you're here, because last week it took us 7 hours.
You know, that brings back a lot of arguments that happened in the war household when I first started running trails, because I'd say, oh, we're only going to be gone for 2-3 hours, and it would be 9. It'd be dark by the time I get home, and there would be mixed words.
Oh, I think we've all been there. I mean, it's like I got to the point where I'll be home sometime between 1 and 1.
call the cops if I'm not home before morning.
Right.
Yeah, and bringing a light. You know, it's in talking about these extra long events, and you never know what's going to happen. You go on a training run. It's so important to bring a light, or bring a little extra food, or bring a jacket. And it doesn't seem like you need it when you leave, but boy, 9 hours changes a day and changes conditions a lot. It's good to go prepared.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Throw in a light, throw in a jacket. It can never hurt.
And speaking of discussions on the trail, I always love the 4 to 5 hour run, and then people spend another 45 minutes in the parking lot. It's like, yeah. What? You guys couldn't finish up that conversation?
After you finish, there's still stories to tell.
Still talking. It's like, at what point didn't you know that you were just about to finish back at the parking lot? You could have wrapped some of this stuff up then.
So we
like each other, apparently, and that makes it fun.
Yeah, well, this has been a pretty good audible.
Well, it was like we were on our own 15. We had to move quite a ways down the field with this audible. It wasn't like just another first down and a field goal. We had to move all the way down the gridiron. So there was a lot to talk about.
We did. And we had to run a little. We had to pass a little. We had a couple of fourth down conversions along the way. But it's all right.
We lost some yardage on a couple of my comments.
a few penalties,
some fumbles. but those who are keeping score and know that this was an audible, if you haven't already read it,
read,
go get Tribe by Sebastian, Junger. Is it Younger or Junger?
Yeah. Well, I think he says Younger.
I think it's Younger.
Younger.
And read it. It's a fairly short read. It's on Audible. So you can listen to it. It's a great book. I've read it 3 times now. And Sebastian has agreed to come on the podcast and talk to us about the book because it's such a great book and it relates to our community. So get the book and read it, and then you can be up to speed when we finally do get him on.
Yeah, and I'll take responsibility for Sebastian not being here. I'm sure it was the scheduler's fault, and I was a scheduler. He's probably on East Coast time, and we're on West Coast, or something has happened. So we'll get that straightened out and look forward to a great conversation with him. And he's a runner. I didn't know.
A fast runner.
A fast runner. Yeah.
4:12
mile.
Yeah. And somebody said they knew what he ran a marathon in?
Below 3 hours, right? 2-something marathon?
Yeah, 2:20 or something like that. So
yeah, it was fast.
He'd be up there in the front of the pack.
That's why we felt that he could come on and relate to us.
Yeah.
So I think great audible, guys. Thanks for the conversation. We'll continuing to get out there and run.
Mas.